You ever feel like you put your trust in the wrong person's hands? While back, I was hiking with some friends, and many of you know Steve, Tall Steve. He was leading the expedition, which should have been my first warning that this was probably not going to go well. And we were hiking up towards Tobermory. It was a five-hour hike that we were going to be going on, and Steve can get you into trouble, and so we were hiking along with him, and he's like, this is a beautiful path, you know, up by Georgian Bay, clear water's going to be gorgeous. And so we're hiking up by Tobermory, and there was points where we'd be along the path, and it would just end, it would come to the water and end, and I'm like, well, like, what do we do now? And he's like, well, we got to wade through the water, get around these rocks, it'll pick up over there. I'm like, I didn't bring my bathing suit. There was a point where there was this dead tree. We had to crawl up this dead tree 20 feet. I could have been impaled. He's like, come on, you can do it. Go, go, go. I mean, it was a beautiful hike, but I really felt like I had just really put my trust in the wrong person's hands, because we got to this the grotto area of Tobermory, and he's like, come on, you go in the water. I didn't have my bathing suit, so I had to strip down to my underwear. I'm swimming in my underwear. And then finally, it's time, we're heading back to a pickup point. We're going to be picked up, and we're hiking through. And he's like, I know a shortcut. It's this little path. I know a shortcut. A shortcut, oh boy. I'm like, okay. So we follow him into this shortcut through the trees. And I can't tell you how incredibly full of mosquitoes this place was. It felt to me like this was the Burning Man of mosquitoes, like 70,000 of them showed up for 1 week to express themselves creatively at this place. It was just mosquitoes everywhere, and I had my wet underwear over my head trying to keep myself from getting bit by mosquitoes. It was just awful. I'm like, this is just, what have I gotten myself into? We're walking along the path, and all of a sudden we hear, yeah. And Steve stops. Oh my goodness, it's a rattlesnake. And I cannot tell you in that moment how both terrified and excited I was, because I'd never seen a rattlesnake in the wild before. And so Steve, we're getting pounded by these mosquitoes, so everybody, you know, sort of carries on. But I'm there and I can see this rattlesnake. I'm like, wow, it's about 3 feet away. And so I did what you do. I picked up a stick. Because when you encounter something like that, you should really poke at it. And so I picked up the stick, and I don't know what I was thinking, what it would do. Well, I kind of knew what I hoped it would do, bite the stick, but I poked, and it went, you know, kind of, I'm like, ooh. And I didn't get bit, I'm here. So I poked it again, and it tore off like lightning through the bush the other way. Thank goodness not towards me, or I would have been in big trouble. But I've never in my life seen a rattlesnake in person, and in person, in the flesh. And I was both, the experience was just so full of fear and wonder at this powerful thing, fear. You know, I come to think after experience like that, sometimes there are experiences, though, that can only be had when you're willing to take less worn paths and when you're willing to sort of poke at things. And, you know, when we catch up with Moses with where we were last week, this is, I think, I can imagine a small token of what he's about to experience this morning. When we left Moses, he was inside of this serious identity crisis, right? And he's running from himself, and he ends up becoming a shepherd in Midian. And he spends 40 years in this self-imposed exile as a shepherd. He's failed in Egypt in trying to be virtuous, and so he's like, he's off in the middle of nowhere, spends 40 years there. And I can imagine that during that time, he finds a sort of rhythm to life. A routine. He settled into a quiet life of migrating his flocks on familiar paths and grounds. And in the midst of that ordinary routine life of shepherding, this is what happens to Moses. Now, Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight. Why does the bush not burn up? He makes a decision. He's going to go poke at this strange sight. And so he's doing what he's always done. For the past 40 years, he's just tending sheep, doing his thing, when he notices a bush that's on fire, but it's not on fire. And then he makes a significant decision. He decides, I'm going to step out of my routine, the familiar, the ordinary, and I'm going to go and I'm going to take a look at this thing. I'm going to poke at this thing. I want to see what's going on. I think there's something significant for us as we consider Moses as the epitome of virtue, the birth of virtue, and it's this: stay curious. I think curiosity is essential for us to grow and mature. Moses could have just kept going, but decides, I need to be curious here. You know, I think this is true relationally, be it in marriage, a friendship, whatever. For a relationship to grow and not become stale, it requires what? A curiosity of the other, a desire to learn and explore more of that other person. I believe this is true creatively. It's certainly true intellectually. It's positively true in terms of faith and virtue. I don't believe you can grow in faith and virtue without a continuing curiosity around Scripture and Jesus and faith. I don't believe you can grow in virtue without a willingness to step off the path, take a less familiar path, step out of what is familiar and comfortable. This is what Moses does. He makes the decision to follow his curiosity. And in that, he has a divine epiphany. And what does this say of God, that God is revealed in a burning bush, but a burning bush that's not consumed? I love what Duncan Rayburn says about this. What Moses has here is the concrete experience of encountering the sheer strangeness of pure contradiction. I love that. And I love the way God seems to be taking the stage in the book of Exodus. God first appears in a cameo. And in his cameo appearance, he blesses the trickery of the midwives. Then God is revealed in the form of feminine virtue. And now God is revealed as pure contradiction. I love it because seeing a burning bush that's not being consumed is like listening to a song that you can't hear. It's like seeing a picture that you can't see. And I think the unspoken but instructive aspect of Moses' experience here with God is that his experience of God is one of ambiguity. He encounters God as something that cannot be solved or figured out. And Moses accepts that, chooses to interact with paradox. You know, I really believe this is a deep sign of maturity. Moses has matured enough to the point. He's grown. He's ready. And so I believe it's the same with us. The sign of maturity is, I think, to encounter something that's deeply ambiguous, pure contradiction, and to interact with that without trying to solve it, resolve it, or fix it. And, you know, this is easy in theory, but really hard to live out in practice, dealing with ambiguity, which I think speaks to the role of doubt in the church. You know, for some, the idea of a church that would embrace doubt is hard to remain in because we don't want to live in ambiguity. That's hard. The interesting thing to me over time is this. The flip side of that is that I think there are many of us who say we value a church where doubt is important and embraced, but it doesn't take long before we actually can't handle that. And so our doubts end up becoming our certainties. Because we can't handle living in the paradox, in the tension, in the ambiguity. And so we have doubts about prayer, about resurrection, the afterlife, the role of church, and those doubts can sometimes end up becoming certainties. And why? Because living in paradox is really tough. To continually interact with something that we cannot get our heads around becomes exhausting. And yet, that is how God is revealed here. You won't get your head around this. I'm a burning bush that does not burn. And so the role of doubt in the life of a Christian is, of course, one of intellectual honesty, but it's more than that. The function of doubt in the life of faith is to keep us in the realm of mystery and the tension of paradox. And then God speaks to Moses by name out of the fire and immediately invites Moses to participate in this experience by taking off his sandals. You're on holy ground, Moses, so take off your shoes. That's always seemed really odd to me. What is this about? I think simply this. Moses is invited to make one small step of participation, just one small act, one baby step towards what God is calling him to. And you know, as I grow myself, I'm coming to think more and more that this is how virtue works in our lives. One small change, one small step at a time. And yet, I don't know about you, but my propensity is never that. My propensity is always to take on something so huge. We had a very exciting weekend last week at our house because my daughter Zoe was having her first sleepover. First time she had a sleepover, having a friend come and stay the night. And an hour before her friend arrived, she came to me with a very serious look on her face. And she said, "Daddy, can I talk to you about the sleepover?" I said, "Yeah, okay." She said, "Can you promise me you won't say any bad words?" She said, "I don't want my friend to pick up bad words from you." And, of course, I asked the most absurd question. I said, "What bad words do I say?" And, like, she was in full-on lecture mode here. She's like, "I will not repeat those here." I was very confused. What are you talking about? When do I say bad words? I mean, I do, but I didn't know she heard it. When do I say bad words? She's like, "Oh, you think I'm sleeping at night, but I hear you when you're watching hockey." Okay, I won't say any bad words. Your friend won't pick them up from me. And I was so humiliated being lectured by my six-year-old daughter. I was talking to Kristen later. I'm like, "I am never swearing again, ever." She's like, "Oh, okay, this ought to be interesting." And of course, I swear, it's cathartic, all right? It's something that happens in my day. And so very quickly, throughout the week, that fell off the page a little bit. You know, it's one of those things for me that I'm like, I don't know about you, but my propensity is to always start with this impossible idea. Never will I swear again. Or I will never eat sugar or carbs again. Or Kristen and I, this late August, we were like, I was on a little rant. I'm like, "We need to be more hospitable. We must have more people over for dinner all the time." So we sat down and we made a list of everyone we thought we should have over for dinner. People from her work, from the neighborhood, her social circle, from Nexus, just list. And we calculated it, and we would have been having dinner with people every Friday and Saturday night until, like, February. And so we both kind of looked at the list and were like, maybe not. Like, that's a huge task, but this is always my propensity, is I'm always like, I feel impassioned. I'm going to take on something. I'm going to make this big change in my life. And what I've come to think is this. When you have, like sort of I do, this all or nothing mentality, the nothing ends up winning quite often. Our big plans, they exhaust us. They end up feeling impossibly out of reach. How can I do this? And when you think about what God is about to task Moses with, the liberation of a people from Egypt, that's pretty big. That feels like an impossible task. And Moses is certainly going to express his doubts about that in a moment, but there's something beautiful and instructive to me about this simple act. Just take off your shoes. Let's start there. A simple act of participation. A simple act. In the summer, I read Richard Beck's Stranger God. Like, anything Beck does is just absolutely phenomenal stuff. And in the book, it's a reflection on hospitality, which is where I might have got a little impassioned. But it's also a reflection on the methods of St. Teresa Lisieux's, her ancient work. It's called The Little Way. And what both books point to is this. The work of virtue is done in small things, in the little things, in the next steps. For example, what both Beck and Teresa make a point of saying is this. Always start small. For instance, you want to make the world more peaceful. You don't necessarily need to join this big sort of political action. Here's what Beck says. Figure out how to treat the next person you meet in a way that takes their concerns and full humanity into consideration. Start with the next person. You want to be less cynical? Start with 5 minutes of gratitude practice every day. Small things go a long way. And for God and Moses, with Moses, it starts with, why don't you just start by taking off your shoes? It's a meeting with God that produces immediate action, small action. Immediately God tells Moses, there's something you can do. It's not big. That's coming. But start small. And then again, here, God and Moses are about to get into a conversation. And notice again here the mode that God speaks in, feminine virtue. Contrast Pharaoh, who is the epitome of toxic masculinity, he is both blind and ignorant, who neither sees nor feels, with God here. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Remember the exact structure of Pharaoh's daughter finding Moses. She sees the basket. She hears Moses crying. She has compassion. Exact same thing going on here. God sees, God hears, and then has compassion, and then tells Moses, you're the one to make it happen. Deliverance. There's just one problem with Moses, and that is he is absolutely crippled by self-doubt. As the story unfolds, he has so little confidence, so little self-esteem, it becomes almost comical, this conversation with God. I mean, his identity crisis is in such full swing here. And Moses is going to resist no fewer than 5 times. And I love the story because it tells us that God, like, is increasingly getting frustrated, angry. And I think what happens is we see in Moses this. We see the structure of self-doubt. I don't know about you, but I find that incredibly relatable. I'm plagued by self-doubt about, like, everything. Just everything. I'm always second-guessing. And I don't think it's just Moses and me. I think one of the biggest surprises I've encountered in 14 years of pastoring is just how many people I talk to who are incredibly racked by self-doubt. No confidence. So many of us lack this healthy sense of self-esteem, and would say this, it needs to be pirated. It's an economy that needs to be broken through. And so I want to consider Moses' 5 moments of self-doubt, because I think the structure of self-doubt is revealed to us here, and it's interesting. Moses' first thing is this. Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? He's tasked with a divine calling, overcome with self-doubt, and his first objection is simply this, I'm a nobody. I'm part of a shepherd clan. I'm part of a clan of nobodies. I am way too ordinary to be taking on Pharaoh. You know, this is always the structure of self-doubt. Called to something, our self-doubt screams what? But you're a nobody. You're a nobody. You're so painfully ordinary. How could you be called to that? And what I love about God's response is, yeah, I think you have to read it almost with a sense of laughter on God's part. He responds, but like I'm going to be with you. Like, you think this is about you? Like, to God, Moses being a nobody is like a minor detail. It's irrelevant to the plot. I'll be with you. It's as if God is saying, Moses, are you human? Yes. Well, that's the only qualification I've ever needed. And so God begins in conversation trying to dismantle Moses' self-doubt here. And it starts with kind of, realize you're part of something bigger here, Moses. You're not alone. I'm going to be with you. And the second, though, Moses said to God, okay, well, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? What shall I tell them? Now, this is interesting, this one. It takes a little unpacking because what Moses is actually doing here is a power move, a real power move. Essentially, what this resistance is about is, I don't have authority power. I need authority power in order to live out my divine calling. You see, in the ancient Near East, to know a god's name was to have power over that god. This is illustrated in Egyptian mythology. It's fascinating. One story, the god Isis poisons the god Ra, and Isis refuses to heal Ra unless Ra will reveal to her what his secret name is. And so Ra reveals his secret name, and Isis then gives that to Horus, and Isis and Horus then are more powerful and more knowledgeable than Ra. And I think, well, why does that matter? Well, because Moses grew up in Egypt. He would have known these stories. What he knew is, if you can figure out a god's name, you have power over that god. And so Moses is thinking, if I can just figure out God's name, this burning bush god, I will know how to relate to this god. In fact, I'll even have a measure of power over this god. What Moses is looking for is the power that comes with naming something, which I think we all know to be true in life. When we name things, we essentially have power over them. Naming is taming, you could say. It's to take something and place it under our control. Let me, at least in a measure, let me illustrate what I'm talking about. You go to the doctors and you don't feel well. Something's not good. You go to the doctors and the doctor says, we're going to need to do tests. Now, in that moment, right, there's a sense of weakness and vulnerability. What is wrong with me? I don't know what's going on. I feel powerless. And here's the thing. Even if your diagnosis comes back negative, like you got high blood pressure, you have cancer, even if it's negative, to name something is to have some measure of control, because if I can name it, then I know how to attack it. I know how to take it on. So if it's high blood pressure, okay, now I know, what do we need to do? Well, we need to have this medication. If it's cancer, okay, do we need to do chemo? To name something is to take it out of mystery and to have a sense of control over it. And so naming things can be helpful for coping in life, but it can also be really, really dangerous, especially if we don't name things well. Let me give you an example. That person is just a snowflake, or a bigot, or a stupid conservative, or just an angry atheist. And our propensity to name and label people, it's a taming act. Because if I can name you, then I've got you tamed. Oh, I know your type. I've seen your type plenty of times. I know how to deal with this. I know how to deal with this. You can tame a person. You can tame the mystery right out of a person with a label very quickly. But it's so shallow. And you know, how we name things matters. Our words matter. To name things well is really important. And I think that means asking better questions. I remember a conversation with Melissa Bowman one time. I was talking to her about, you know, I pick up my kids from school. They come home, and I'm like, how was your day at school? They're like, good. I'm like, oh, what did you do? Nothing. You know, and I was frustrated by, I couldn't get any information out of them. And I remember her saying to me, well, why don't you try asking better questions? And at the time, I was like, ouch, that hurt a little bit. But I honestly think that should be like our life motto. Ask better questions. Whenever we find ourselves frustrated with something, a position, understanding someone, maybe the problem is that we're not asking good enough questions. Instead of naming things poorly for the sake of taming it, why not ask better questions? You know, it's interesting. You strike me as a conservative or liberal or whatever. Can you tell me more about that? What kind of conservative liberal are you? Could you tell me more about the content of your ideology? Why does it make sense to you? But I'm digressing here. You see, Moses is dealing with his self-doubt in the way many of us try to sometimes, and that is, well, we need more power. If I can get more power, then I'd overcome my self-doubt. But God is sort of having none of that. He's like, I'll give you my name, but it's only going to make your head spin. So God's response to Moses is nothing short of what I would say just shocking delight and profundity. God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. I don't even know what to do with that. I just know it wins in terms of the names of gods like Zeus, Ra, Horus, I am. That's just an awesome name. What does it mean? I love, again, Duncan Rayburn. This makes my head spin. I love he says this about God's name. God is the ground of being. God is so perpetually present that he transcends all dimensions of presence and absence completely. God is more present and more absent than both presence and absence.
What?
God is both the is of is and is not. God transcends the chain of being altogether. God is unlike anything you and I can know, but is knowable at the same time. I have no idea what that means, so I'm not going to say any more about it, but it's just, like, just totally out of the realm of our knowing. And you would think with that, Moses would be like, okay, this is pretty intense. I'm ready to go. No, new tactic. Moses answered, well, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? What's going on here? Self-doubt is so often expressed in worst-case scenario of what other people will think of us. Moses has been wounded in the past. He's been burned by insecurities, and his sensitivities have him focused only on what might go wrong, what others might think of him. And you know, I find this so relatable. I swear Moses is an Enneagram 6. Like, he is just really struggling here. I totally get this. This blew my mind this week. I was not expecting for this. I was in the LCBO going to buy a bottle of wine. You know when you go into a store now and they're always asking if you want to give to charity? And you're like, hey, do you want to give $2 to kids something? And you're always in that moment, right? You're like, oh my goodness, I'm going to look so awful if I say no. And I hate being surprised by that. But this guy took it to a whole other level. Got up, scanned the wine. He's like, hey, do you feel well enough to give to charity today? What? Do I feel well enough? That to me seemed like an impossible. I was like, yeah, I guess I do. I don't know how you say no to that. Because if I say no, then do I have to explain why I'm not feeling well? I don't know. It was just like, oh, or worst case scenario. You might have seen me run away this morning. I had a nosebleed this week. I get them in the winter. And I was sitting there and I was going, oh my goodness, what if my nosebleeds while I'm talking to you guys? Like, wouldn't that be the most awkward thing in the world, because my nose would be bleeding. So I ran back there and shoved Vaseline up my nose so we could at least keep it at bay. So that's the way my mind works. Worst case scenario, what could go wrong? What could go wrong will probably go wrong. And this is Moses at this point. He's like, well, they're going to laugh at me. They're going to sort of throw me out. They're not going to believe what I'm going to say. And this is the funny part to me, is Moses is wearing God down. And I kind of love it, because he's taking on the Jacob wrestling with God role. And what we've realized is that when you wrestle with God, you can actually get somewhere. Jacob did, and Moses is about to get somewhere too. He's like, no, can't do it, full of self-doubt. And so finally, God is like, oh my goodness, you are so stubborn. All right, you want some parlor tricks to dazzle some people with here? Fine. So Moses, throw your staff down. He does so, it turns into a snake. Pick it up, it becomes a staff again. It's interesting, even in these sort of parlor tricks, dazzling people, God speaking about what he's going to do. What's that about? God is saying, that which has become serpentine will be corrected. And then he says to Moses, go ahead, stick your hand in your pocket, bring it out. What's happening? Oh, it's got leprosy, it's diseased. Stick it in again, bring it back out. What's happening? It's healed. What's God saying? What has become diseased will be healed. So are you ready, Moses, to get on my side? Because this is what I'm about. I've revealed to you who I am. I've given you some amazing parlor tricks. Are you ready? And Moses still. His fourth one. Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. Is it just me, or does Moses sound incredibly eloquent and articulate as he is describing how ineloquent and inarticulate he is? I almost feel like you have to read this with a British accent, right? Pardon your servant, Lord, for I am slow of speech and tongue, right? Like, he just sounds like, Moses, you got this. Like, you sound fine to me. You can clearly speak. I think you'll be okay. You know, this is fascinating to think to me about self-doubt. It keeps telling us that we don't have what it takes. We're incompetent for the task. And oftentimes, it's incredibly obvious to other people that that is not, in fact, true. But the self-doubt keeps whispering, you're incompetent. And God's response at this point is he's about to lose it. God says, man, do you know who made you? It's as if God's saying to Moses, do you think I'm like, oh, shoot. Now, you know what? Now that you remind me that you suck at speaking, you're right. I'm going to get somebody else. Forget it. Out of here. It's like, I made you. You think I don't know all about everything about you? And if I've called you to something, then you'll be ready to go. Now go. I'll help you speak. I'll teach you what to say. Your self-doubt is becoming exhausting. Give it up, Moses. Just go. Trust me. And then the final one, Moses is like, nah. Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else. Moses goes through all of that. And what's so telling to me here is this. Moses is a wreck. He just has no self-esteem, no confidence. I mean, he's just broken by it. But at this point, Moses is just shirking responsibility. And I think a lot of times that's what self-doubt leads us to, leads us down the path. You know, it's okay to be full of self-doubt, but at certain point, self-doubt can cripple us to the point, you know what, you're just shirking your responsibilities. And, you know, there's a time and place to really think through when that might be for someone else to worry about something, right? We can't do everything. We can't be called to everything. There's a time and place to say, you know what, that thing, that cause, whatever it is, that's not for me. I'm already working into my own divine calling here. But this is right in front of Moses. And his self-doubt has debilitated him to the point he's just shirking responsibility. But you know what? He wins. He gets in the ring with God and he wins. God's so frustrated. He's like, fine. Take Aaron. He can speak well. Take your brother Aaron. The two of you will be like Penn and Teller. You'll be the brilliant one. He'll do the talking. So Moses is in, ready to head to Egypt with his brother. But you know, two things stand out to me as I think about this structure of self-doubt we see in Moses. First is there. I've been talking a lot about divine calling, and I think that's confusing to a lot of people. What do you mean by that, Brad? We don't hear from God in burning bushes today, so what does that look like for us? Just quickly want to throw this at you for you to think about. Your divine calling is this. What do you want to do, your desire, plus what are you talented at, or what are you willing to put the work in to get talented at, plus community affirmation. I believe that's how God speaks to us today, divine calling. And I would say that the difficult part is we so often leave out the last one, the community affirmation. But I believe in the New Testament church, God reveals he speaks through his body, the community, and we so often don't get community affirmation. You want to know where your divine calling is, what God's calling you to. I think it can be found there. We could talk a lot more about that. But here's the other thing I take away from this story. I don't know about you, but I really, really resonate with Moses' self-doubt. I struggle with it, and I think it's become an epidemic culturally. We struggle to love ourselves, to see ourselves as valuable, to feel that we are good, worthy, enough for the task, enough to venture out and be bold. And then, of course, sometimes we overcompensate for that. So we go fishing for compliments, or we go tooting our own horn, thinking if we lie enough to ourselves, maybe it'll make it true. And the truth is, we can't see ourselves the way God does, and it results in vicious self-talk, brutal self-doubt. And as you read this story in Exodus 3:4, I mean, it's almost embarrassing to read and hear out loud. It feels kind of pathetic. It's like you want to scream at Moses, dude, you've got this. I mean, how often does God need to tell you that? How often do you need to be affirmed and encouraged? I mean, get over yourself. How often do you need to hear God affirm you and encourage you? But here's the thing. The answer to that question seems to be this: often. A lot, in fact. And that's where this comes home to me. We are all Moses. And if Moses needed it, then we will too. Moses is us, we are Moses. And if Moses could experience crippling self-doubt even when a burning bush is talking to him, we can be sure we will experience self-doubt as well. And if Moses needed words of affirmation and affection and encouragement directly from the mouth of God, how much more are we going to need it? And so here's the takeaway for me this morning from this. We as community become the mouthpiece for God. So give that gift to people as often as you can. Give the gift of affirmation, affection, and encouragement with reckless abandonment. I don't know why we're so slow to speak encouragement to people. I'm very guilty of it myself. I give encouragement, I think, too sparingly. Affirmation too sparingly. Affection too sparingly. But let's give it with reckless abandonment. Let's give it to our partners. Let's give it to our friends. Let's give it to our neighbors. Let's give it to our kids. Let's give it to the people in this community. We all need words of affirmation and encouragement. And I think if we're going to pirate self-doubt, then we're going to need, in a world that bangs us all up pretty good, it's not going to be easy, but what we're going to need to do is recalibrate and establish a culture that says we will be the ones who encourage, affirm, give affection. Because have you ever had that? Someone spoke a word of affection or encouragement or affirmation to you at the right time? It does worlds of wonder. And I know that someone, probably many here this morning, we need that because we're struggling. We're sinking in a sea of self-doubt. And so can I simply say this as we close? Can we please be slower to criticize and critique? And what I've come to learn is this. The people we often want to criticize are already beating themselves up inside. They probably don't need more of that from us. Let us be slow to critique and quick to shower others with affirmation, affection, encouragement. You're Moses. The people in your life are Moses. They needed it. So do we. So let me close again with the words of Henry Frederick Emil, and then I'm going to ask Katie to come and close us in a beautiful prayer she shared with me this week. But this sort of benediction by Henry Frederick Emil has become, I just keep going back to it and trying to make this my thing this year. Life is short. We do not have too much time to gladden the hearts of those who travel with us. So be swift to love and make haste to be kind.